testimony on Judiciary Wednesday, April 4th, 1:30 p.m., full committee work session, page 38, side 1. On House Bill 2297, House Bill 2271, House Bill 2351, House Bill 2776, House Bill 2810, House Bill 2905, House Bill 2190, and House Bill 2333.
First committee, Judiciary will come to order. First, will note those present that have been guiding the queue to other side of the light. We're going to put off the consideration of the notice statute until about 2:15. And how often is here going to join us if we were to go to the podium? We will be looking at House Bill 2271.
I believe it'll do it.
Give you a little background history of that legislation. Prior to the last session of legislature, Judge McClennan in Multnomah County was privileged. Judge called me and asked me to provide a lawyer to assist him in conducting the sanity hearings in Multnomah County. And I advised the judge that I didn't have staff allocated by the county commissioners nor state legislature to provide that type of legal assistance. I further advised him that if we really needed that type of assistance, in as much it was rare, to my knowledge, in many counties, for them to provide legal assistance at that point from the district attorney's office. As he would go with me before the Board of County Commissioners and certify the need and satisfy them, and if the counsel would be provided, that we would do it. Judge McClain declined to do so, stating that it was his problem. I declined to provide assistance, stating that I didn't have the personnel to do it. Following that, Judge McClain returned to the next legislature, put in a bill to require district attorneys to appear at the request of court in those cases. I advised Multnomah County that it would have a budgetary impact if it did pass, and that we were opposed to it because no need had been demonstrated to me. And I talked to other circuit court judges throughout the state of Oregon who had indicated to me that they conduct such things without assistance and do so without any problem. The bill passed, and subsequent to that, I went to the Board of County Commissioners, and Chairman Clark chastised me for requesting an additional deputy DA that his county council had drawn the legislation on the bill, and his lobbyists had testified in favor of it with Judge McClain. Nevertheless, despite that, we were able to get one position, and we provided them this type of assistance. But I tell you, I think it's wrong. And I think it's wrong for one philosophical reason, which disturbs me, and I think it's wrong for a second reason, which is a very practical application of our office in the courtroom. Philosophically, I think it's really wrong to have a prosecuting attorney in that role, and remember that basically that's all we do is criminal prosecution in Multnomah County. We have county counsel for all civil work. Sanity hearing, as all of you know, I understand there's some discussion of it, but it is a civil matter. And I think it's wrong to permeate that courtroom in sanity hearing with overtones of criminal prosecution, because the prosecuting attorney is there prosecuting the case. It seems to me that philosophically it's much better for the person who is attempting to commit, and for everyone else, if it's dealt with as a civil matter by people who handle civil matters and not by a prosecutor who's handling basically only criminal prosecution. I talked to a lot of lawyers on that point, and have not really found anyone in disagreement with that feeling of getting the aspect or the feeling of crime out of that room. That they're not criminals, and they're not to be prosecuted, and they should be handled by people in civil matters. Multnomah County, that would be county counsel that was created, carved off from the district attorney's office to handle all civil matters. The second reason is one of practicality, and that reason is that because of the substantial caseload that we have in these types of cases in Multnomah County, we find that it is not at all unusual to have conflicts. We found ourselves on many occasions to be handling a sanity hearing, prosecuting it, claiming the person should be declared insane, and at the same time, the same person has a criminal case pending in our office where we're asserting that he is, in fact, legally responsible for his conduct and not legally insane. And therefore, should, and I told the judge about that, and We didn't feel that was a problem. We wrote to the Bar Association and requested an opinion on the ethics of that, and we refused to handle those cases, feeling it would be unethical to assert two different positions concerning the same individual as a lawyer for the state in both instances. The judge chastised us for writing a letter to the Bar Association even requesting an ethical opinion, if you can believe it. But in any event, we have not received the opinion as yet, but I think it's a clear violation of ethics to assert two inconsistent positions in representing the same client, which is the state of Oregon. I talked to John Leahy, Joan, I think he called you, and I talked to him and said, oh my God, I don't want it. So I hated it when I was doing it in Lane County. I understand your problem. I told him that, there's no sleight of hand involved. We're going to switch the budget to his office. He'll have the position that we have allocated to that. But it just seems to me that that it makes sense to continue treating it as a civil matter and take the conflict, the ethical conflict, out of the situation.
John Leahy is the county counsel.
He's county counsel,
argued for retention of the job in your office, or has he simply argued for retention of some such adversary role for some attorney?
In honesty, Dave, nobody wants to do it. I'm just being very honest about it. I think we've got a better case not to do it than anyone else because of the conflict situation and because of the prosecutorial atmosphere that it creates. I sincerely believe also, just speaking practically from our office viewpoint, that the judge would be better served. It is a relatively low priority matter in our office. People disagree with that who are not in our office, but my people necessarily look towards prosecution of major felony crimes as being the priority, and this kind of takes a back seat, honestly, because of the fact that it does not have that kind of priority, and secondly, there is a real dispute of opinion as to whether or not it's needed. In the amendments we proposed, we said in counties where there is county counsel, that it would be county counsel. And if I'm not mistaken, in many counties where they have not separated yet and have county counsel, like Lynn County, they still in that office carve out a section of the office who are dedicated to doing civil work. So we've got some division there, unlike our office. I would even be happy to see an amendment to the amendment, which would say either in counties where there's county counsel or the district attorney, either the district attorney or county counsel shall. And let the counties work out who should do it. Because I think that we can be persuasive to the commissioners that it makes much more sense for it to be treated civilly by
citizens.
Is
there anything about
In Mullen County. I think there's a lot of other counties that they will, unless you pass legislation we have in front of you, requiring attorney judges, I don't think you really need it. But we have one lawyer dedicated to that now. The court wanted to, has requested, demanded that a second lawyer be provided because they wanted to run hearings simultaneously. We've refused to do that. Supreme Court asked Judge Branning from Clackamas County to look at it. He's talked to me and talked to the judge, and I'm waiting on a report from that. But we just didn't feel we could commit two lawyers operating simultaneously, and both of them said suddenly nothing to do all afternoon because of the inability to schedule consecutive hearings for some reason. Apparently, there's some feeling in the people that the mental health division that was inconvenient for them to have to testify all day long, whereas they could do it just in the morning. But it was inconvenient for us too.
I like the bill just as it was. I just
got to
find convincing about the
amendment. I like the bill just as it is.
Are
these your amendments? Yeah, there are amendments. I just wanted to propose the amendments. I'm not really offering them, but try to show you the conflict that exists in that I don't like the status quo, and I can live with about anything but the status quo if we can amend that. And I quite frankly also have problems with, honestly, philosophically, with the judicial branch of government ordering the executive branch of government to appear before them and prosecute certain cases. I wonder about the constitutionality of that kind of statute.
From the judge's standpoint, though, it puts them in the business of prosecuting and executing at the same time.
I think that, that's been Judge McClain's concern, and I think all judges, if we were judges too, we would feel that same type of feeling. But I think perhaps it's better to have a court have a, if you will, a budget, and then to have someone appear, you know, on behalf of the state to do that other than the prosecutor, right?
So I haven't been to several, if I hear the change, there is, and the way the things kind of drop out, there is some of those prosecuting, and I have to even see them, and they both look like that. And sometimes I think that the arts and the feeling, I'm not being facetious, they're usually just plain seeing the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And there's sometimes the feeling on the part of some people that they need someone there to kind of defend them from this nasty old lawyer, if he's raising things like evidence or objections for sure, so.
I think you're right, Tom, and really when the court started getting running a little scared on the situation, it's been the institutionalized defense for the person who's thought to be committed in the public defender's office has that function and became an adversary in the situation. The court then felt, you know, there was an adversary there, the court then felt it was drifting into an adversary situation, that it wasn't quite that way before, but it is that way. And I guess it just boils down to should a prosecutor be mandated to provide the service, setting aside the question, let's say, should the service be provided? Given if it should be provided, who should do it? And shouldn't let the counties determine, at least where you have a civil fire in the criminal case.
Any questions for the next call? I was looking at my notes here, but I don't remember how many folks knew the earlier that we had testimony, but. Dr. Bloomer, the Board of Psychiatry, Mr. Fossling from Maternal Hills, Dr. Christian's letter, Dr. Clevin, Dr. Dina Salzberg, and Dr. Ed Kobach, all just like vigorous support.
Chad, if I'm not mistaken,
the original bill,
but I think that every one of them would assert that they don't really care who provides that legal assistance. I mean, they don't really care if it's just the attorney's office. And that's really, and I can understand that. Sure, that doctors testify they want lawyers in the courtroom, but as we all know.
Well, just speaking for myself, I couldn't buy your bill in its original form because I think you do need somebody to be the orchestrating it at some point. I think I could go with your amendments, and I guess I wouldn't even mind the alternative if not the transmission broker it out and mm-hmm. appropriate funds. What's the feeling of the committee?
I agree with you. I'd be assigned to prosecute and administrator and to represent the minister. Discussion? Objection? Adoption. Chair moves the adoption of the amendments as amended House Bill 2271. Second?
Objection. From your conceptual amendment and the language contained already in the proposed amended bill.
The proposed amended bill, I guess, doesn't make it clear that it can be either or, if I'm not mistaken.
The proposed amendment says that if there is a county council, the county council shall do it, and if there's not a county council, the county will shall do it. And the amended proposed amendment would say that it's up to the county to decide which office will do it.
So the conceptual amendment then changes the instead of it shall be a section four, to that extent.
Oh, so the discussion is going to be your comment was that in conceptualizing the amendment to the amendment, that if the VA would broker it out, would you visualize that it's the VA's primary job to determine whether county council or just an internal?
I think that's going to be the effect of the amendment would really be that the county commission would broker it out, because they're the ones who would be appropriating the position.
That's what I think.
With the meaning that people such as I would have to take the case to the commission rather than to out on the list.
Any discussion? Clerk, call the roll.
Aye. Aye.
Mr. Thomas,
the motion, please?
Yeah, the motion is to adopt the amendments as amended. The amendments as amended would leave it in the discussion of the individual county whether the function of providing representation of legal counsel, in essence, to the state would be done by the district attorney's office or the county council's office. Or, for that matter, I think the language of the bill leaves it open that they could be able to appoint someone to the county council.
As I read the amendment, it is not the case that the county could select someone else. It's either the county council or the district council.
I'd rather read it that way, Mr. Chairman, it's also in the respect the county council has council.
As 2351, which haven't been placed in 2438, which then goes on, which doesn't want at all, and therefore it's a prime candidate for table.
And note for the record before I place the motion that we do have a fiscal impact statement for whatever it is worth on the scale that shows a fiscal impact of $5,202,000. Then the motion is moved to table the bill, not debatable.
Well, they again, Mr. Fossling of Multiple County Mental Health, Dr. Berlin, and Dr. Kobach. Mr. Fostering read a type of warning that is given as a matter of policy by the department, and there was nodding in the audience on behalf of Dr. Sullivan and Dr. Kovac that it was sort of a normal type of warning. It's not true in Miranda, but if there's a warning to advise the individual, it's going to be similar. This is a hearing which may very well decide him of his freedom or her freedom. And they were very vigorous in asking that silence not be mandated because the victim had to decide the way to deal with it. Because the reaction of the injury was very important to their professional determination and not for the people.
Any questions?
I've got very mixed feelings about this bill. On one hand, I think it's a good bill. That's kind of my civil libertarian side. On the other hand, I do realize the doctors do necessity for the free entrance. But then I might note, give the committee the benefit of my experience, and that has been that the key to a successful mental commitment hearing on the part of the defense attorney, at least, the primary key is merely keeping the client quiet. In fact, it's almost impossible to make someone who won't open their mouth, literally. And in my experience, if they'll keep their mouth shut, they can't be committed. It's also in my experience that the people that really do need commitment don't keep their mouth shut. And that all the same courses, all the same commands can get them to keep their mouth shut. And that you can give them all the advice that you want, and they still don't keep their mouth shut. I remember one specific case where I insisted that he be fired by the United States Supreme Court. I insisted this for about an hour.
Well, I'm just wondering what the consequence of failure to advise the
defendant
that they had his right.
It was my point that was brought up.
There's no protection in here.
Even if there was some sort of a suppression or some reason to dismiss the proceeding, would that be in the best interest of the person in the state? It strikes me that maybe it's a nice idea, but I'm not really certain that it's going to help anybody.
Well, it does change the whole metaphor of the proceedings and those of the civil proceedings actually to criminal law.
Okay. I tend to look upon these proceedings as fairly arbitrary, but regardless, the judgment call probably will not vote for it, even though I can appreciate the theory behind it and it. But I think that the stuff that we do pass this may be able to be actually make it a bit more arbitrary than yours. It's already too arbitrary.
I'll
give everybody most of something you can vote for. I'll move the table house before we come.
Clerk will call roll.
Most of the people who testified on the bill were not aware of the amendment, but Justice Levin opposed the amendment on the ground partly that the psychiatric security review board probably already has jurisdiction to prevent people from owning or possessing guns, and partly on the ground that there's no provision in the amendments that a person falls into either of these categories, A or B, have any notice of the fact that he or she is prohibited from having a gun. That was an objection to the bill as the original draft was too by the people who objected to it.
That's my
point.
Again, I don't like to discuss it, but Dr. Blaine very critically that the amendments were adopted. And my opinion is that Mr. Fostering dealt with the bill as it was drafted and not the amendment. He was against on the basis of the bill as it seems to. I think there's some merit to it. The testimony, again, I don't want to tell anybody who doesn't, but I know some of us left in large numbers that day. So the testimony was that there was an interesting case where a police officer had a problem with regard to possession of a firearm by this individual who was not otherwise misusing it, but had been convicted. Maybe that's wrong. I've been found to have mental illness and probably shouldn't have the firearm, which was conceivably pretty dangerous. And it's kind of one of the horror stories, but I think there is some value to considering empowering the agency to do something about taking the gun away and taking it.
I see, even with amendments, I see a constitutional minefield here. For instance, paragraph B, pursuant to such, you found mentally ill, was described in paragraph such and such, committed to the health division. Then, if you were found mentally ill, and then you did own, or possess, I have no control. Notice those three words in there. If you're found to own, possess, or control a firearm, suddenly you're tipped into a Class A misdemeanor. And what that will do is bring a collateral criminal consequence into a commitment proceeding. And once a collateral consequence comes into the commitment proceeding, you're going to have to get full due process to commitment proceeding. Here's an example. In the Trinity Field, in Florida, there was a civil hearing which determined obscenity. And once the civil hearing was determined obscenity, then you could be charged criminally for having the possession of disseminating the obscene material. And the court said you couldn't do that. You couldn't use a civil hearing to establish the element of a crime. So if you're going to use a civil hearing to establish the element of a crime, you're going to have to, that element, and that hearing and that element have to have all of the baggage that comes along with it. Another example, the Duffy case from Oklahoma County, which said that the first DUIL was a preponderance of the evidence, and that you didn't have a right to jury trial and all those other fine things, but now your second DUIL became criminal. The Oregon Supreme Court said, no, you can't do that. If you're going to make it again an element of a crime, you have to give them all of the due process requirements to make it an element. So what you're going to do here, if you pass even an amended bill, you're going to introduce an element in here which is going to come back to haunt us on jury trials. That's just one thing there. You have to give them a jury trial on a civil case because it becomes an element of a further crime later.
I'm looking to table House Bill 2776. Clerk will call a roll.
No.
Mama.
Aye.
Nathan.
Aye.
For others because of the team gap in the law, and I appreciate the problem that one thing's my conviction that I'm more afraid of the person's own welfare and that of other people in social proximity.
Nothing
but
most of the general public doesn't know what
we're
doing, and those people troubled by mental illness, I'm sure not even less what we're doing.
and I want to have a $5 fine and you're in jail. But then you're going to be treated to the number of the violation of that person.
I would be willing to work on amendments to try to decriminalize it, but in some ways take the weapon away from the
Well, Sarah's going to be willing to explain the motion to take it off the table if you wanted to work on it or try to do this. But I think until we have some language before it, I'm sure you're going to have a problem. Let's see what I can do.
No.
House Bill, you just have 20 minutes. If you do, I do. You know, I'm not going to I'd like to see the people around here. House Bill 2905.
This bill ranges from 2 to 3 the number of persons who can initiate a commitment investigation, prohibits the use of behavior altering drugs during pre-hearing detention, and requires that the arrested or mentally ill person be given due process rights, including the right to trial by jury and community hearing. It was opposed by the Mental Health Division, Montgomery County Mental Health, Dr. Jessica Bloom from the University of Urban Health Sciences Center, and Ben Taylor from the Veterans Administration.
Was that the assistant here at that time?
No, he wasn't.
Was that the assistant communicated with us at all with respect to the bill?
No. There was a woman here testifying who listed herself on the sign-up sheet as a registered assistant to the Veterans Administration, but did not send it to the student for him.
That's my committee. So move Table House Bill 2905. Let's call roll.
Aye.
Bob Olson, here from the bar. Could you explain this briefly?
Mr. Chairman, that just came out of subcommittee that I was on the other day. John said that they had made a change in the agenda. And so far as the other matters are concerned, it simply updated and clarified the law with respect to fiduciary. I don't really think there's any reason to oppose the bill. It's none of my concern
that day. You give the fiduciary the same power basically as the administrator of the state who has and
the testimony was that the by changing to allow investments in management type investment companies or investment trusts, as an example of mutual funds, that smaller estates should be managed at less cost than would otherwise be required. At the present time, the law doesn't permit the fiduciary to be investing in the fund because that would be a delegation of the fiduciary responsibility.
Okay.
But the small states have been trying to get out of the business to run out of the market. Nobody can afford to handle it. Not be able to go to professional advisors anymore. So that's what they're requesting.
And finally, just to pass the bar convention, we're going to go to the bar. Was there an amendment in something that was coming to the agenda?
Aye. lieutenant for contact participation to the
company. After 2333, abolishing the volunteer commission.
That was also a bit of a place with testimony from Tom Crescent indicated that the law enforcement committee has become more a management and farming out committee than substantive committee, that the legislative council committee at the same time has become more active and could therefore take over the work of the law enforcement committee in undertaking major studies if that's what they want to do, that the law enforcement committee has become unnecessary.
It's unfortunate, it has a relatively narrow relating clause, and if it didn't, we could pass all of that. It's a lot of money for the question, and if you have something on the end of the
The only way to really do to apparently save it is certainly to file the appeal.
Mm-hmm.
No question.
You know, in all honesty, we looked at it and we're arguing it, and you know, we don't know. Somebody's going to make a decision on it. The you know, the reason we drew the bill was that we just thought that this more accurately reflects what the people really wanted, what their frustration level was directed towards, rather than the, you know, if there is such a thing as a normal, quote, mom-pop homicide that a lot of people call it that and are familiar with, that occurs once in a lifetime and never to occur again. I know Jed had expressed some concern about the role of people, and I will tell you, I have those concerns too. I personally do not support the death penalty, I support the law as it is now, and intend to proceed under the death penalty provisions as the law directs. I don't think this does any violence to the death penalty statute that we have. I really think that it addresses the penalty towards those types of crimes and those types of offenders that the public perceives as deserving of the capital sacrifice.
Well, in a way of dialogue. Well, actually, although your terminology is unusual in the context of it, so you don't think it does violence, but in looking over the bill, the drafting, we find that it needs to be revision in order to contemplate all the crimes that are enumerated in the mixture.
Mm-hmm.
And you wouldn't touch them all if that was the intention.
Well,
now, I don't know what, you know, this is like to be about what if 225 or 50,000 people seeing the tax bill, you know, makes it about. But I don't think everybody looked all the way through that thing and carefully reasoned out just exactly which violations they wanted punished by death. But I think we have to almost be guided by that type of assumption, even though it might not be particularly.
So you could argue, because it would have come up with reading, you know. They didn't even have that there was a mandatory minimum in the aggravated murder statute, so it misdirected information to the voters. You could certainly argue that. I just say this to you. I'm not sure. We did this because we drew this legislation because, as prosecutors, we felt that for the people who want a death penalty, we feel this is a more responsible death penalty than the one we have. That it's going to deal and provide that penalty to people. That most people would agree if there is going to be a maximum penalty that these people would be the ones who'd want directed towards. The other thing is, as a practical matter, the way the present law is it puts prosecutor in an interesting situation of probably going to have to try every murder case that occurs because there's no real incentive to plead to any murder charge that can be issued. Because you're either going to get death or you're going to get 25 years. There's no intermediate step for those taking of lives that occur where there are factors that are more understandable than your rape, murder, or what have you. It's up to, you know, the legislature to decide if, in fact, you want to deal with it, but I really don't think, in my judgment and talking to them, I've talked to probably 5,000 people in the last 2 years, most of whom in the speakers expressed a desire for a death penalty to me, and I don't have any problem saying this is a responsible death penalty, this is what the people of the state of Oregon would approve. I wouldn't have any problem except that if you wanted to refer it. I think it's a more responsive penalty. I'm going to say, just what Ted talked about, there were a couple things you left out. Well, there were several things that were left out of the one that was initiated also. And the process of legislation is just that, to come up with a better mousetrap. So whatever you want to do, we thought that as the county that prosecutes most of the homicides in the state, that we could provide a service to members of the legislature by bringing you a piece of legislation that we felt is deserving of your consideration. And how you wish to deal with it, of course, is just not.
Well, under the ballot makers, the spousal murder in a kind of fashion, but not to the point where it's reduced mental capacity. Is that a minimum 25?
I believe so.
Do you prosecute that as death or a minimum 25?
You have to do one or two things. You're going to have to You know, Dave, we hate to get in a posture to indict for murder and to hold the, I just think it's too much power for prosecutors to indict for murder and hold the death penalty of 25 years over a person and let them differ for a manslaughter. I'm not sure, you know, if you haven't taken away quite a bit of freedom of choice with the threat of that murder prosecution in the present statute. And I place yourself in that situation, and with a lawyer talking to you, well, you know, if you go to trial, and if they convict you, you conceivably, I don't think so, but you could get the death penalty, but you will get 25 long ones. Now, here's manslaughter. I think the bargaining positions are too substantially different. So we're saying if we think it's manslaughter, we're going to indict manslaughter. We just don't want to get in that position of bargaining and from those unequal positions, because I worry about a person potentially making an error in judgment, pleading for a crime that he possibly could get a verdict on. There's just, you know, it's all or nothing under that initiative. It's an innocent situation. I just think that there needs to be a fail-safe of some sort. And I think this one gives us that kind of fail-safe.
Yeah. Yeah.
Could
this
force,
what it would cost your office,
cost
you every homicide?
No, we don't now. We have three homicides presently that could be capital cases, will probably be treated as capital cases, and we're keeping time records not only of our office but of the investigators and everybody else on it. But I would guess it'll be another 60 days. Although one case is going to go to trial in about 2 weeks before we have three cases. And you know how they are, they all are different. And of course, the first ones are going to be undoubtedly astronomical in cost, because we know it'll go all the way to the United States Supreme Court. The test constitutionality.
You
The test constitutionality. The thing that's going to increase our costs, not only investigatively and everything, but the thing that will increase is that we're going to have to be very careful that we don't over-indict and we don't over-convict. And we're going to have to do an extensive amount of research into the background, the psychological background, the social history of the defendant, to ensure that he is, in fact, the type of candidate that the people were thinking about when they passed it. So it's undoubtedly going to, what I say,
Let me be too simplistic, but I tend to feel what I think of representing the people. We're nothing worse than the people measure. We're going to be wary of that.
I'm looking at that column here, for number 8, I'm looking in the middle column down near the bottom, and we're going specifically that set, subsection 4. If we think the trial judge renders a negative finding on any issue submitted in this section, the trial judge shall sentence the defendant to imprisonment for life, if that's the address error. And that sounds like about 25 years, and that would be a minimum sentence. Okay, you've been talking about 25 years, is that
correct?
25
years.
Okay. Could we amend only that portion and allow for, unless there is a recommendation for a lesser period of time by the prosecuting attorney?
I know you do.
Okay, basically what you're doing is, in negotiation, you say we won't take the position, or we will take the position, either position is for the maximum term, which is available. And you put it in this case, saying we do not feel as good as a life state. We feel a person is amenable. We feel a person deserves five or ten years in prison, but not life. And we'd like to take that into consideration. And at the time you negotiate, you could negotiate on the basis of the recommendation. We will recommend.
You got it. I'll tell you one of the problems we have, it's digressing a little more, but it kind of falls in that area, is plea bargaining of that nature when you don't have all the facts. We're struggling with the problem now of making a saying, telling defense counsel you'll. We'll recommend five, and we haven't seen the pre-sentence report, and the pre-sentence report comes back that he's a raving maniac with kind of rape and plunder. We didn't have that available to you. You know how the, you know, the sequence of events, you don't get it until after the fact. If in fact we had the type of workup on the defendant, it wouldn't bother us to make a recommendation of that nature. I don't know how the court would feel about it. I'll tell you one of the things that we see, I'd like to give you a hypothetical. Under the law as it is now, the initiated law, we're going to have a defendant who is legally responsible for his conduct. It'll be a close question. You'll have two psychiatrists going one way and two the other way. And he's going to have had maybe a prior assault and some other assaulted type of conduct, criminal history. And he's going to claim the insanity defense, and we try the case, and he's kind of bizarre murder, and or maybe even a barber brawl type of thing. And he's going to get convicted. And we're going to have a person that most people think either should be locked up or should be in a mental institution. And he's going to be a prime candidate in the law if the court follows the law for the death penalty. Unlike these type of people that we've enumerated here. But, I appreciate your feelings. I didn't, you know, I know that politics can be in the bill. It's you know, you say people have spoken, and I really agree with that. But I just got a feel, Ted, that when they were talking about Marquette and Bowles and those type of closest release decisions that we saw, infuriated me.
Well, you know, as you get more, as you read more of it, you realize there's more conflict with existing statutes. For instance, the treatment of the 25-year sentence is, frankly, just an abrogation of our old concept of the nation. And I guess you got to say that people legislated last. We legislated in 1979 on a matter of tightening up, we thought, fairly well
on, but I don't know if that's been successful.
Well, I don't think that's a matter of opinion. We sort of agreed with the concept, you know, 2 years ago. That's what I'm saying. We sort of said, go this route, have judicial conference consideration with the parole board, and this is all happening. And we've heard some testimony here that, you know, indicate that as far as some of us are concerned, they're kind of doing what we in this committee thought we were doing when we passed the bill out, and that passage. But what I'm saying is, I think there's going to be a big case in that, it's going to be a challenge the first time was violated, that the people have legislated subsequent to our 1977 law and is therefore modified. And now, if we have the arrogance of coming back and modifying their modification, I think we're in for great trouble. And not only that, but that's a pretty resounding expression.
Well, I think they want a death penalty. I don't think there's any doubt about what death penalty. Ted, you know that you and I went down here on State Street and stopped 50 people and asked them what the death penalty, what type of people would be put to death in the present death penalty law of the state of Oregon. No, 25 couldn't give you any of that answer.
I know.
You know. I'm not talking about getting rid of the death penalty. I'm just talking if we shouldn't use an M1 rather than a shotgun. You know, and that's kind of the approach we've done. On that matrix thing, so I'm going to a press conference tomorrow, but kind of jump it shortly. In 1975, the parole board released somewhere around 720, I don't have exactly what it was. In 1978, they released over around 1,670. There's been a 136% increase in the number of people paroled, while there's only been a 36% increase in the number of admissions to the Oregon Correctional Institution. And it's gone from 33% of the sentence served in 75 down to 24% of the sentence served in 1978. We just feel that right now, the first time in the history of Oregon, look, every time a man goes in the door, a man goes out the door. And that happened in 1978, the first time ever.
I think this whole thing is just really correct the idea of the politics of it. And we're all politicians, and we're half of the politicians. And it's all in our minds. We're all accused of what you're doing. Politically expedient. And I have no doubt that not passing this bill would be politically expedient. Because you just leave alone. I think it's irresponsible. This is a judiciary committee. And this is a committee that supposedly operates a cut above other committees. This law supposedly
funds that for the
effectively or economically defended under the defense part of the defense bar that put people in peril of their life who have no reason to be put in peril of their life. Solomon's belief is unfortunate that this bill preserves the intent about measures after the death penalty would be returned. But I've got to go back and tell you some of my constituents who want some type of responsible legislation. I probably got one of the few districts that was voted against about major age. At the same time, I think you're talking about responsibilities here. And this is one I feel pretty strongly about. I guess because I'm going to be placing the position of having to defend the mom and pa murder. And if you hit deputies, they're going to have to, play God with some unfortunate individual's life with, because it's going to be there. The pre-trial processes were going to sit down and play those games. And neither one of us want to play those games in that inappropriate situation.
What do you think,
Corey? Well, I think that I've laid out those things in my discussions with my constituents before I got elected and before the vote was taken on death penalty. We talked about the economics and we talked about this, and I have to assume that to the best of my ability, I did my job to explain the ramifications of Measure 8. And the people voted for it, and I think they voted for it. And so I'm here not to do anything political, but just to say I don't believe it's our responsibility to make those kinds of changes. Regardless of what economics were involved, I think I explained the economics to the people involved that I talked to in the thing. As best I could, which is widely recognized. I certainly want to say I don't agree with the organization that my vote is going to be one that's worth and murder. That's conscious. I'm under some real conviction, and that I'm not prepared to try to come up with such and such a better death penalty. I just don't think that's what the voters wanted us to do, was to come up with a better death penalty.
Is the person doing justice there?
But I just want to say it's not, I guess my political motivation is different than what my friend mentioned.
Well,
somewhere between the supervision and class express, I think that we do have an obligation to make right something that is wrong. And it may be a tough decision, and that's where I'm stuck. It's a tough decision. I don't know how best to correct something that people have enacted. And I thought I had a question. Like, could you, if I was other than, refresh me on the gap between manslaughter and this, what are the definitional and sentencing gaps?
Oh, God, what is that? 15 minutes. 15?
15?
Yeah.
15 minutes
is
a gap.
Yeah, put that in there. You know, I mean, that's a. That's not a gap, that's a canyon.
So it's 10 years versus a 25
years. Yeah, it's just,
I don't
really
have that
big
assume, but I'm not a prosecutor, so I don't know.
You're
the one that's...
Well, you got the taking of a human life, and,
Well, he's talking about short gap. You've got a horrible problem. Short
gap. Mm-hmm.
That's a difficult.
Yeah,
that's really because of what Norm talked about.
Yeah, because you say food, and we won't go to the death penalty, but you just, you get 25 dead ones, and it's a guy, we can't get 25 without parole or anything like that. But you can get, and if you let us plead to manslaughter, which is 10, and you may be out in, well, if you're sold in 24% of the time. I got his figure.
I know, but you're telling
him. The people released have been sold in 24% of the time. Okay, so he'd be out talking, we'd talk to him today.
We could, I suppose, establish a category of second-degree murder. Some people suggest that I think that would be amazing.
Would you
want to
comment about second-degree murder?
Yeah, some people suggested that we have a different category of murder. That's what I'm recommending. That's what I'm suggesting. The table, we can change it totally to 22 and 97, we can make minor amendments.
Turn the clock all the way back, pre-repeal of the death penalty, and look at what we had before, just 50 new seconds, the old classic scheme. Because that has a certain attractive, old-fashioned logic to it, which I think people understand. Some of the complaints I've had with the model penal code is that public protection of crime and the model penal code classification of crime differ. And after centuries of the public protection of crime, the common law crimes had their public validity to them, public understood them, and they still understand them. You might be able to go back to first-degree murder, second-degree murder, and that would essentially, I think you could argue that would fulfill the public desire, what they wanted about major age. You could argue that, because the public wanted the death penalty back, and in their mind, they wanted back first-degree murder, second-degree murder, manslaughter.
The other thing this does is that it's the thing I like about it, it basically sets out where the death penalty, the legislature, through the people, are choosing who's going to be the candidate for the death penalty, rather than a prosecutor. And, of course, I like that. I think the people that are prosecutors in Oregon are ethical, and I don't see, hopefully there's not a lot of over-indictments and over-prosecutions. And that type of thing, but that has occurred elsewhere, as we know. And I like it clearly established, where you say, if you do this, this will happen. And people are kept constant. And as I leave here and get a witness to them, I just like to say I'm very happy to have brought this man to you, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you for the gift. Is this
something that's not to do? We have a motion to refer to that meeting for further work with
We had a work session a week ago and
spent
hours on it.
I think we just need to get to the rest of the program. It's probably been long instead of telling how the team is for widely different reasons. There's no reason to have to read it because it's 3 or 4 months. And then we've got it with people. Mm-hmm. But we're only 8. We may well be here to be on here with part of it.
I move that we adjourn for the day and not act on this deficit to the desires of our chairman and possibility that a subcommittee might follow through with us.
Well, I'm going to appoint a subcommittee before I place the motion if we're going to do this. As I can't know, there might be 5 soft votes to table a bill. That would require a motion to untable it if further action seems possible. Chair is not here, and I know that you're going to be strong views, only haven't expressed to me what they are. I think I know at least Representative Smith feel that other approaches might be viable. I'm going to appoint them as subcommittee too. Come back to this is to see if we have a wider range of alternatives than it is presently to be the case. Any objection to that course of action? Other than from the few members I just pointed out. Then we'll just move to adjourn. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Okay.